You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, I have a couple of quick announcements as we kick off the new year here. I hope you'll help us fund our production costs for 2017 so I can keep providing you brand new podcasts twice a week. Show your support for the show by giving to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. Whatever you can give is always appreciated and will help us keep going over here in 2017. I also want to ask you to take a brief listener survey so we can better understand you, our audience, and find advertisers who are best matched to your interests. Just take 5 minutes to go to podsurvey.com/kick and take the survey. And when you're done, be sure to register to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Again, that's podsurvey.com/kick. Thanks for listening, and now enjoy the podcast.
And now Greg Louganis.
Louganis hits the board. That is disaster.
That's a clip from the shocking moment during the 1988 Summer Olympics in Seoul when diver Greg Louganis struck his head during the springboard competition. Louganis revealed his remarkable courage and tenacity when just minutes after a medic stitched the cut in his head, he returned to the board and performed the best dive of the competition. The next day, he won the gold and secured his legacy as the greatest diver in history. A four-time Olympic champion, Greg Louganis is the only male to sweep both the 3-meter and 10-meter diving events in consecutive Olympic Games in 84 and 88. Louganis earned a total of 5 Olympic medals, including 4 gold and 1 silver, as well as 5 world championship titles and 47 national titles, more than anyone in U.S. history. Greg Louganis has been inducted into the U.S. Olympic Hall of Fame and the International Swimming Hall of Fame. He's the recipient of the AAU's James E. Sullivan Award for Outstanding Achievements, the Jesse Owens Award, and the U.S. Olympic Committee's Robert J. Kane Award. His autobiography, Breaking the Surface, spent 5 weeks as the New York Times number one bestseller, and he was the subject of the 2014 Emmy-winning HBO sports documentary Back on Board. Today, Greg is a mentor for the U.S. Olympic diving team, a judge for the Red Bull Cliff Diving Tour, and a motivational speaker. And on Monday, January 2nd, he will serve as the Grand Marshal of the 128th Pasadena Rose Parade. Today, he'll join me to talk about his remarkable sports career and some of the hurdles he's overcome along the way, including his heartbreak when the U.S. decided to boycott the 1980 Olympics, that infamous head injury in the 88 Olympics, and how he came back to win the gold the very next day. He'll also talk about his battle with HIV and homophobia, both in the pool and out of the pool, including the Wheaties box controversy, his experience during the Russian Summer Olympics, and a strange encounter he had with Vice President-elect Mike Pence. Plus, what he's doing to mentor today's Olympic athletes and help them adjust to life after sports. Coming up with Olympic gold medalist Greg Louganis in just a moment. Greg Louganis is widely considered to be the greatest diver that ever lived. He's the winner of 4 Olympic gold medals and a silver medal, and he's the only athlete to win golds in both platform and springboard diving in the back-to-back Olympic Games in 1984 and 1988. He's also a number one best-selling author, a mentor to competitive divers, an activist for LGBT rights, and an inspiration to those living with HIV. On Monday, January 2nd, he'll serve as the Grand Marshal of the 128th Pasadena Rose Parade, an honor which he'll share with his fellow Olympic medalists, Janet Evans and Allison Felix. Greg Louganis, thanks for joining me over the phone.
Sure, my pleasure.
How did you get into diving to begin with? Because weren't you originally studying gymnastics as a kid?
Yeah, well, I started when I was a year and a half doing acrobatics and dance, jazz and tap. And then I got a partner when I was 3. I was performing on stage. And then my partner went into gymnastics, and I followed her into gymnastics when I was about 7. And then when I was 8, we had a pool built in our backyard, and my mom didn't want me to kill myself, so she got me lessons. And the first day out to lessons, the coach asked me if I'd join the club team, and I said I'd think about it. And my first love was gymnastics, so it was my hopes and dreams to make the Olympic team in gymnastics. But when I was 12, I had it's called Osney Slaughters, which I guess is I understand is pretty common with young, active kids. And so I was having water on the knee and having it drained, and it was really painful. And so my doctor said that I could continue diving, but I had to quit everything else. So all of those disciplines, dance, acrobatics, gymnastics, all of that energy was focused into one discipline, and that was diving. A year later, I was world champion for my age group, and 3 years later, I was on my first Olympic team.
You were 16 when you competed in your first Olympic Games. Did you feel that you were ready then?
In 1976, I was this young kid and, not really proven, but Klaus DiBiase was going for his 3rd Olympic gold medal in men's platform. My coach won 2 gold medals, 48 and 52, helped coach Bobby Webster, who won in 60-64. And so an Italian was going to be breaking their record, if he were successful in Montreal. So my sole purpose on this earth was to prevent Klaus from winning that gold medal. All of my training sessions were about beating Klaus. He'd always set up the situation. Okay, Klaus is leading by 12 points. You need 9s on this dive. Well, sometimes I was successful and sometimes I wasn't. But it was all about beating Klaus.
Your next shot was going to be in 1980. But in 1980, the U.S. boycotted the Olympic Games over the Soviet war in Afghanistan. Now, with a pretty limited window as an Olympic athlete, you only get so many shots at winning the gold. Was 1980 frustrating or maybe even heartbreaking to put in so much time and dedication and then have to just sit that one out?
It was a heartbreak. It was, I was one of the team captains of the 1980 Olympic team. We chose an Olympic team, and what we wanted to do, and our voices were never heard, was we wanted to send one athlete in carrying the flag to the opening and closing ceremonies. And then we had an incredibly talented team in all sorts of disciplines. So we wanted to go there and do really well, but have our voices heard by just not participating in the opening and closing ceremonies as a team.
And you said that if you had gone in 1980 and if you had won, you probably would have retired and moved on because you weren't really enjoying the sport as much. Why weren't you enjoying diving at that point in your life?
Well, I was in college and I was a theater major, minor in dance. And so, I really wanted to pursue my, my career in either theater or TV or film.
You won 2 gold medals in 1984. And I think nowadays it looks to many as if you were kind of upstaged by Mary Lou Retton when it came to the endorsement deals. You didn't get a Wheaties box. You didn't get the I'm going to Disneyland commercial. How much of that did you think was perhaps because potential sponsors thought that your personal life could have been a liability for them somehow?
There were so many stories out of the 84 Olympic Games. We had so many, incredible stories. Nancy Hogshead, Rowdy Gaines, Edwin Moses, Carl Lewis. But the media, just kind of surrounded Mary Lou. She was like the little Energizer bunny, like kind of latched on to that. I mean, but, that's life. That's the reality of it. But a lot of us, on the outskirts are like, we're not on that caliber.
Yeah.
And that's a choice that's made by advertising agencies. So those kinds of things are kind of out of your control.
Yeah, it must be somewhat offensive when you're told by some corporation that you don't fit their idea of what healthy or normal is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but you know what? That's fine. I mean, because I was with Speedo for many, many years, mm-hmm. and then I was also with Banana Boat.
Right.
I had a number of contracts. One of the things that as an athlete you sign as a talent or spokesperson is a morals clause.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. As athletes as well? See, because I always think of that as being old Hollywood studios that would do that.
No, that's probably where they got it from.
Yeah.
But you sign a morals clause. So in 84, my contract was up with Speedo because it has to have an end date. And so Linda Wagner, who at that time was president and CEO of Speedo Authentic Fitness, she said, well, we want to extend your contract. And that's when I had been working on my book, Breaking the Surface, with Eric Marcus. And so I said, Linda, we got to sit down and talk. And I told her, what was going to be in the book, and it come out about my sexual identity, and as well as my HIV status. And she, all she was concerned about was she didn't want me to lose my house.
Mm-hmm.
And because she had so many friends who died around her and, part of the AIDS epidemic and, in the fashion industry and the arts and all of that. And so she said that, well, my commitment's for life and I don't want to see you lose your house. And so unfortunately, Authentic Fitness went into chapter 13 and she was no longer there. Cause she was my champion. And then, they just made it impossible for me to meet my requirements. And it was causing too much stress. I walked away from it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you did finally get your Wheaties box just, a couple of years ago?
Yeah. Just last year.
Last year. Okay. So you didn't take that personally.
I really didn't. I don't pay much attention to that sort of thing. It really wasn't until we started working on the documentary Back on Board, and we were at the International Swimming Hall of Fame at that time in Fort Lauderdale. And, there's this hallway and you walk by all of these Wheaties boxes and you see all these athletes and everybody made a big deal about me not being on the Wheaties box. And then I looked and saw who was on Wheaties boxes. And I was like, oh, no wonder they made a big deal about that.
Yeah.
It's really kind of rather auspicious that I was kind of missing.
Yeah, and the next time that you went to the Olympics, that was a difficult time in your life because you were just diagnosed with HIV, I think the same year that you competed in the Seoul Olympics in 88. Now, this was a time pretty early still in the AIDS epidemic when, you know, Liberace had died just a year before, Rock Hudson had died just 3 years prior. In the late 80s, AIDS was still pretty much a death sentence. Did you even think that you would be alive today at that point? Did you even want to compete in 88?
Well, what happened was when I got tested, my cousin did the test. We did it anonymously. And then when it came, my thought was if it came out back positive, then I was training in Florida at the time with my coach, Ron O'Brien. And my thought was I was going to pack my bags, go back to California, lock myself in my house and wait to die. Because that's what we thought of HIV at that time, you know, that it was a death sentence.
Yeah.
And so in talking with my doctor, who is also my cousin, he said the healthiest thing for me was to continue training. This was 6 months prior to the Olympic Games. And he said, you know, there's no telling how long you have been positive. So, you know, the healthiest thing for you is to continue training. You know, the only problem was, you know, we couldn't tell anybody because had anybody known about my HIV status at that time, I wouldn't have been allowed into the country of Seoul, Korea to compete at that Olympic Games.
Yeah, I think, didn't you say that your coach had to sneak in your AZT in his bags?
Yeah, because he didn't want to take any chances.
On top of all that, during the Olympics, you had what I think looked like a pretty bad accident where you hit your head on the board. Did you have a concussion? It looked serious when I watched the video.
I was totally conscious through the whole thing.
Okay.
So I, you know, I'm sure I had a minor concussion, but, you know, I just kind of grazed the top of my head. So I had a laceration, so it had to be sewn up. And it's more the mental aspects of it because I didn't have a chance, the opportunity. I only had, I think, 22 minutes or something to prepare for my next two dives. I had two more dives to finish the prelims. Yeah, that next dive was pretty scary because it was going in the same direction and reverse. So I didn't have a chance to kind of process it. I just had to kind of set that aside like it never happened.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's the kind of thing that could really mess up your mental game as an athlete under pressure. What did you do or what did you tell yourself to shake that off and be able to focus and compete the next day?
Thankfully, the finals were in the morning because it was a sleepless night trying to figure out what I did wrong, all that stuff, and hitting my head on the headboard occasionally and just, you know, waking myself up. And then I had to take my AZT every 4 hours. And so, I mean, it was a really restless night. And Coach Ron O'Brien, he, you know, I couldn't have done it without him. You know, he pretty much kicked me in the butt. But the training session prior to the finals was unlike any other preparation for any other finals that I had ever competed in with my coach, Ron O'Brien. He kept having me do repetition after repetition after repetition, where normally we would be on a taper. So you go in and you do your dives and you get out, make sure your body temperature's up, you know, ready to perform. But yeah, it was so much about building my confidence back up. And once I got the dives under my belt, and then the final started, and I just got stronger and stronger, you know, through the competition. So it was really, I mean, we got through that Olympic Games together.
Yeah, and you retired after 1988 when you won another two golds. After you retired from diving, you were absent from the sport for, I think, almost 20 years. Why did you decide to leave the sport for a period?
One, I mean, I had other pursuits. And also, I mean, I also didn't feel very welcome. You know, and I've talked to other divers about that. You know, it's like they were like pushing talent through, you know, and so it's like, don't let the door hit you on your way out. You know, you don't go where you don't feel welcome.
Yeah. Did you feel that that was homophobia, or was it more just you're not competing anymore, so we don't have any reason for you to be around?
You know, I think that there was, you know, because a lot of the powers that be at that time were people that I used to dive against that I beat. So, you know, who's to say how much of it was jealousy, how much of it was homophobia? I know my coach said that, you know, you'd be surprised. It's, you know, he felt that it was a lot more about homophobia than I did. I tried to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Although your close friends and family knew that you were gay, you didn't publicly come out till I think around 1995. Now, help me out with this, because if I had been you and I had been an Olympic gold medalist, I would have thought that the best time to come out would have been when you're returning from Seoul with two gold medals around your neck, you're the greatest diver in history, everybody loves you, and you're retiring from the competition at the top of your game. I would have thought that would be the best time to possibly come out. Why did you decide to wait?
One, I was diagnosed HIV positive, and two, I was in an abusive relationship.
Oh, yeah.
So physically and mentally abusive relationship. So when I went home, you know, I heard rumors of things that were going on that Jim was doing. And so I had to play detective and found that I only had $2,000 to my name. Everything else was in his name.
Wow.
Or held jointly because he had power of attorney while I was busy training. I was preoccupied with that. And then in 89, my dad was diagnosed with cancer and he passed in 91. Jim filed a palimony suit in 89 and he passed in the end of 90. So,
okay, yes. So you, that was not a good time to add something else onto your plate. That's what you're saying.
Lots of stuff that I was trying to deal with.
Yeah. Well, you did come out of the closet, and you've since become something of a hero in the LGBT community and an activist in the fight to cure AIDS. But you've said that you never thought of yourself as being particularly political. Is that a role that perhaps you're growing more comfortable with now?
Yeah, in light of things, yeah. I mean, it's something that we've come so far. I don't see us going backwards, number one. But also, Hillary sent my husband and I to Nepal because she wanted to outreach to the international LGBTQI people because they were the most discriminated against. And so we went to Nepal for the first LGBTI sports festival in Southeast Asia. And so being a part of the American embassy and being a part of that was, you know, was wonderful. It was great. And it really taught us too how much education needs to happen around the world.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back to talk more with Olympic gold medalist Greg Louganis when we come back in just a moment. Hey, folks. Do you like reading but find it's getting harder and harder to make time to curl up with a good book? Well, there's a solution. Give audiobooks a try. They're perfect for your commute to work or working out at the gym, a relaxing bath, or any time, really. And right now, you can take an audiobook for a spin with a special promotion just for our listeners from Audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickassnews to get a free 30-day trial and download any of Audible's 180,000 titles entirely for free. That's audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now back to the show. Your manager, Greg, had told me that I had to ask you about an interesting encounter that you had with our vice president-elect, Mike Pence, who has been, I think, a proponent of conversion therapy. How did that meeting go?
It was interesting because I was heading up to Indianapolis to meet Jeannie White because it was the 25th anniversary of the passing of Ryan White, who contracted HIV through his clotting factor. And so there was a new book coming out, and I was there to support Jeannie. But as soon as my plane landed, Pence signed the AFRA, you know, into legislation, the Religious Reform or whatever, Freedom Act, mm-hmm. or whatever it was. And so as soon as I hit the ground, it was crazy because I was there for Jeannie and Ryan's new book. But as it turned out, Athlete Allies and Human Rights Campaign Fund, you know, they kind of met me on the ground and said, well, we could use your voice. And so I went to, it was supposed to be a press conference, and I figured, you know, no harm, no foul, you know, I'd just like to hear what he had to say. And then I was escorted out of the meeting. But we watched it from some other politician, I think the speaker or something, his office. And then the following day, Pence invited me to his office. and it was surreal. But we didn't want it to turn into like a photo op for Pence.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I went there with a gentleman from the Human Rights Campaign Fund. I just shared my story, in a very human way, of what it was like growing up gay and all that. And, there have been two times that I've felt like I've been in the presence of true evil.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of them.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. And what was the other, if I may ask, or is that personal?
I did an interview that was when Putin signed into legislation the anti-propaganda laws. I was doing an interview with the BBC from LA, and the man who wrote the laws was on the phone. I think he was in Moscow. And so through London, we were on the phone together and doing this interview. And, late at night, early in the morning, my time here, I turned to my husband and I said, I've just been on the phone with the devil. I swear. It's really terrifying.
And you attended the Sochi Winter Olympics, where Putin had passed this law that basically said gays weren't allowed to kiss or hold hands in public or wave a rainbow flag. Did you break the ban while you were there?
No, I did not go to Sochi.
Oh, I thought you did attend.
I was not a part of the delegation that was named. I was on the short list. Instead of going to Sochi, there was 5 days between the end of the Olympic Games and the beginning of the Paralympic Games. And in that 5 days, in Moscow, they had the LGBT Russian Open Games. I went to that.
Okay.
And Moscow was not Sochi. Moscow is propaganda for Putin.
Mm-hmm.
And, when they found out who the group was, the LGBTI Sports Federation, they turned us away from our hotels. There were bomb threats.
Really?
We were escorted out of facilities that we already had reservations to occupy and have, just panel discussions. We were shepherded off the ice at one venue because Konstantin, he was a figure skater. And so he wanted to do a little, adult kind of figure skating workshop. And they closed the rink down.
Did you feel threatened?
Well, I think had there been less people, there were about 30 plus of us, I think. And I think that had there been less people, we would have been detained.
Wow.
It was interesting because I learned the difference in that, society. It's you have the police, which is more for the people. Mm-hmm. And, they're kind of in their corner. And then you have the Cossacks. And the Cossacks, you know, override the police because they answer to Putin, you know, because he was head of the KGB.
Well, alongside your activism for LGBT rights, you have since rejoined the sport of diving in a way as a mentor with USA Diving. You attended the 2012 London Olympics and the 2016 Rio Olympics to support the U.S. diving team. First, just so I understand, what is the difference between a diving mentor and a diving coach?
Well, in the past, I mean, a lot of times your coach was your mentor.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I mean, there are so many incredibly talented coaches and very knowledgeable coaches. And they're tremendous technicians.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I came in as athlete mentor, you know, it was less about the diving and, you know, less about coaching and more about how do you approach, you know, going to the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting because in 2000, we only won one medal in diving. Fortunately, it was gold, and that was Laura Wilkinson. And we got zero medals in 2004. And then the same thing in 2008. And so it was actually Steve Foley from Australia who was hired as the high performance director of USA Diving who reached out to me and asked. He came out to the house and he said, how do we get you back into diving? And I said, ask. And so he said, you've never been asked? I said, no, nor have I felt welcome.
Wow.
And so he said, well, there's nothing I can do about the past, but we can look forward. And so what we came up with was mentoring. And it was really interesting because my first question to the athletes was, you know, what is your ultimate diving goal? And every one of them would say, make the Olympic team. And then I would say, and then what? They looked at me really puzzled and was like, make the Olympic team. I said, well, don't you want to get on the podium? I mean, aren't you in this, you know, to bring some hardware home? That just wasn't the mentality at that time. And so, you know, and I encourage the kids to start training as if you're at the Olympic Games.
You said that your passion is actually, and this is really interesting to me, the aftercare of Olympic athletes and yeah. How do they re-enter society? And this fascinates me because, you know, I always think of it as kind of like being an ex-president, but having your entire life ahead of you. What is it like when you dedicate 100% of your life to one goal from a very young age, and then you peak at the age of 28 or younger, when most people are just beginning to figure things out and start a life, and then you suddenly have to find something else to do with yourself, some kind of purpose? What is that like? Right. I feel that it's very hard for most people to relate to.
Well, that's the reason why Crossing the Line, an organization that, you know, I've done a lot of work with, and Geroid Toy, I actually reached out, Geroid reached out to me because he was competing for Ireland in rowing, and we just kind of loosely stayed in contact, and then I met Jai Wallace, who is an Olympic silver medalist from Australia, who came out about his HIV status. And just a little core group of us, you know, we're kind of, you know, exchanging emails and what our concerns were. Met up with Rick Cott-Greaves, who posted a questionnaire for Olympians that were in transition, who was there for them, how they made the transition, you know, because we've had so many Olympians having to deal with anxiety, depression, suicide, addictions. You know, it's really very common because you kind of lose yourself. Yeah. You know, you dedicate so much of your life and it becomes a part of your identity.
Yeah.
And then when it comes time to retire from your sport, then it's almost like, who am I without my sport? And so, you know, trying to, you know, find healthy ways, you know, in finding passions and finding, you know, a purpose.
And in recent years, you had a period where you were struggling financially. You almost lost your house. You had gotten taken advantage of by some unscrupulous people. It seems to totally go against this idea that an Olympic athlete wins a gold medal and that's when they can cash in and milk all these endorsements. Is that part of what you want these young athletes to understand and prepare for as well?
I get pissed off at the sports agents.
Really?
You know, I'm also an actor, so I've been a member of SAG-AFTRA and Actors Equity for many, many years. And by law, if you're an agency running out of California or New York, by law, you can only take 10%. Well, right. You know, sports agencies have their hubs in Columbus and North Carolina and Florida and, all over the place except for New York. They do have offices in New York and in Los Angeles, but that's how they charge their, their talent, upwards to 30%, which I think is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Especially for, depending on the sport. Now I can see where, if you're making like hundreds of millions of dollars for an athlete, I don't think they're going to miss 20%, of that. But when you have athletes who were struggling to, make, maybe 60,000 to 80,000 a year, and you're taking 20% of that, that just doesn't make sense to me.
I doubt the coaches even make that much. Which is crazy because they do a hell of a lot more for the athlete.
Yeah. And the thing about the sports agencies is they sign as many athletes as they can, promising them the world. Say, oh, an Olympic gold medal is worth millions and blah, blah, and all that. And the kids are young. They're impressionable and they believe it.
Yeah.
And it's just like, that is not reality.
Before we wrap up, do you still dive for fun?
I don't, but this has been a really weird year. ESPN called me up and said, well, we want you in the body issue. I was like, oh my God, I know what that is. And give me enough time.
That's a lot of pressure.
Give me enough time to get in shape, get my diet in order, get to the pool, get to working out. I had 8 weeks to prepare and I think I did a pretty good job. Another time, Mission Viejo is going through a renovation of the platform. And so they were doing the last dive off the Mission Viejo platform where I trained. I used to train.
Yeah.
And Tom Daley happened to be in town. And so I said, would you be willing to do a dive with me? So we did. And diving next to a 22-year-old, I'm 56, it's like, oh my God, I've got to get to the pool. And so the Rose Bowl was great because Aquatic Center, because they're always very welcoming to me there.
Yeah.
And so they let me, go and get on the boards and making sure that my shoulders would stay in their sockets and, do a few practice dives to in preparation. Yeah. So I ended up diving with Tom Daley, which was a lot of fun.
Speaking of the Rose Bowl Aquatic Center, you are the Grand Marshal of the Rose Parade this year. How excited are you for that? And have you ever attended before?
Yeah, I was actually, Mission Viejo had a float one year with a water element and they were diving into this, this pool on a float. And so I got to ride in the parade with my little Jack Russell Nipper. She's no longer with us, but she was there, and Brian Goodell. They had a lot of Mission Viejo Olympians on the float. But to be Grand Marshal, it was so interesting because when they made the announcement, the big announcement of who the Grand Marshal was, was going to be, they introduced Allison Felix and they introduced me and then Janet Evans, and it's, it, I got it. It's, you know, we have we're trying to get the games back to Los Angeles in 2024. It's all about, you know, the 2024 LA bid.
Ah.
And so that's, you know, that's kind of a big push, and the reason why I was included. So I'm thinking as an athlete, and then after we were introduced, and then reporters started coming, you know, through the line and interviewing each one of us. And one of the reporters turns to me and said, "How does it feel to be the first openly gay grand marshal at the And I said, "Really?" I said, "Are you sure about that?" You know, and they said, yeah. And it's like, wow, that is like really, really cool.
That's funny. I'm trying to think about that. I'm trying to think back. I mean, there may have been some who were in the closet, but I'm trying to remember. They might be right about that.
Yeah. So
Pasadena is a pretty conservative place, you know?
I know. And that got me I started thinking, gee, I wonder if they really thought this through when they asked me to do this. it's just a part of who I am. It's just me,
yeah. You
know, Greg Louganis, who happens to be gay.
Well, practice your wave.
Yeah, the Royal Rose Wave.
Yeah. Well, the Rose Parade airs Monday, January 2nd at 8 a.m. Pacific on ABC. And Greg, where can people keep up with you online?
Well, you can go to louganis.com. That's my website. And keep up with me there. And I'm also on social media at Greg Louganis.
Excellent. Well, we'll look for you on Monday on the Rose Parade. Greg Louganis, thanks so much for joining me over the phone.
My pleasure.
Thanks again to Greg Louganis for joining me on the podcast, and be sure to watch him in the 128th annual Pasadena Rose Parade on ABC at 8 a.m. Pacific on Monday, January 2nd. For more information on Greg, visit greglouganis.com. That's Greg, Louganis. And follow him on Facebook and on Twitter at Greg Louganis. Don't forget to take our listener survey so we can keep the show free and find advertisers who are best matched to you, our listeners. Just take 5 minutes to go to podsurvey.com/kick and take the survey. And when you're done, be sure to register for that $100 Amazon gift card giveaway. Be sure to subscribe to Kickass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. And you can visit Kickass News on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at KAPolitics. And please be sure to recommend Kickass News to your friends on all your social media. And if you really want to help us out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/KickassNews or click on the donate button at KickassNews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@KickassNews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass News. Kickass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.